made a specialty of, and I don't think there's anybody better in the business.
A celebration of Rodgers and Hammerstein at the BBC Proms this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Now it's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
David Hyde Pierce will probably be most familiar to you for his wonderful portrayal of Dr. Niles Crane in the TV series Frasier. He's currently appearing in the West End in La Bette with Mark Rylance and Joanna Lumley. However, David very nearly took another path, a musical one, in fact.
Yes, it's true. The musical world was spared, fortunately, but when I was a young man, I thought I was going to be a concert pianist. I studied the piano and the organ fairly seriously.
What made you decide against it?
Well, I grew up in a small town, which had a very sort of sophisticated musical life. It was the summer home of the Philadelphia Orchestra and the New York City Ballet, so we had a great cultural influx. But when I went to college, I went to Yale, and got into the larger pond of people who truly had a possibility of a career in music, and I realized that I just didn't have the talent, nor did I have the drive that it took.
So how did the transition come then to moving into acting?
Well, I had always acted for fun. Even since elementary school, I would write little plays for my friends to do. And even in college, got involved doing things and sort of had friends who were in the theater program there, which was a more serious professional group, and got kind of sucked into that and realized that if there was a chance to do something that I had so much fun doing and make a living or something at it, then it was worth pursuing.
You've played the organ, though, too, for quite a long time, haven't you?
Yes, I studied both organ and piano. Around age 16, I started studying. I went to an Episcopal church. My family attended an Episcopal church that had a very, quite sophisticated musical life. In fact, the day of my high school prom, instead of going to the prom, I was playing the organ for a Benjamin Britten Memorial concert. So,
really?
Yes.
Now, you've directed as well as taken part in music, and I think this first piece is a case in point.
It's an homage to that, yes. First of all, the whole program is in honor of my being in England. I'm so happy to be working in London, so I've tried to find an English theme for everything. And the first thing I ever directed, I went to a summer camp as a young boy, and they would do a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta every summer. And I was in a few of them, and then when I took over the drama program there, the first one I directed, which was HMS Pinafore.
And did you find the music and the English wit appeal to you?
Completely. It was something that I was cut out for. And I think ultimately led to much later in my career, after I'd done theater, after Frasier was over, being drawn to go do musicals on Broadway. The early influence of that Gilbert and Sullivan experience was certainly paramount in that. And in fact, Spamalot was the first musical I did, which has a lot of roots in that.
Couldn't
sort
be
of
more English
no,
in some ways.
Exactly.
No.
Exactly.
But there's also, I think, on this recording that we're going to hear of the overture from Pinafore, another important connection, which is Charles McCarris.
Yes. Well, having been here for his passing, which is so sad and shocking, and he was just about to conduct at the Proms, and was such a great conductor and so loved by so many of the musicians who worked with him. I just thought it would be a fitting tribute to him.
Well, we could, bearing in mind that it's McCarris, be hearing Janáček, but it's Gilbert and Sullivan,
yes.
Which, of course, for the more British, and the overture to HMS Pinafore.
Thank you.
unredeemably cheerful.
It's just glorious. It's glorious. And I have to say, it brings back such memories of me hammering that overture out on a terrible old upright piano in a lodge in some summer camp. I think Sir Charles did a much better job than I did.
And Sir Charles Mackerras was conducting there the Orchestra of Welsh National Opera, the overture to HMS Pinafore by Sullivan. Obviously, having studied the piano, there's a huge repertoire that you probably came across. But what's always interesting about music is coming across music you don't know so well and performances that cast a new light on it.
One of the things I did being here in London, I'm here for about 4 months, and I set myself a task to go through all of the Bach preludes and fugues, some of which I had known, and I just thought it would be a good discipline. And also the character I'm playing in the show I'm doing is sort of a very lofty artistic type, and I thought, well, that's a lofty artistic task to set yourself. No list, no nothing fun, just pure Bach. So I've been working on that. And
actually, just to pause you a moment, if I may, it's quite interesting, the whole sort of aesthetic of this play, isn't it? I mean, the whole philosophy, it's got a lot to do with art and the whole nature of it. Just tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. It's called La Bête, and it's set in Molière's time. And
by David Hurston, yeah.
David Hurston, wonderful American playwright. And many people who go to the show think, oh, it's a wonderful translation. Which it's not. It's an original play written in 1991, but it's in the style of Molière. It's written in rhyming couplets, set in that time. And it's essentially about, I play a playwright and actor named Elomir, who my troupe has been taken over by a princess played by Joanna Lumley, and she's co-opted us and supported us and give us housing and all that. And now she wants to bring in another actor to the troupe, and this other actor, played by the great Mark Rylance, is a total nightmare, a vulgarian and a slob and every body function that you can imagine he is master of, or not master of. But he also brings a very sort of what you would call a low form of art and comedy into this relatively high-flying troupe. And so the play is about who's on the outside and who's on the inside. It's about the challenges of having a patron and the responsibilities when you're a creative artist. And it's about the conflict between what we think of as ideals versus reality and practicality. And what do we aspire to and what sells?
Well, I'm sure that anyone who loves music as you do would aspire to Bach. Because you can't get much higher than that.
No. And one of the great pleasures of going through the Preludes and Fugues is rediscovering how endlessly creative and innovative and beautiful his work is. And I was always a big Glenn Gould fan, and still am, but of course as a young man, he's so revolutionary and shocking and surprising and gets to sing along with his own playing, which we'd all like to do. And so for years, he was my man for Bach. And then recently, someone introduced me to Rosalind Turek, and I got her recordings of the Preludes and Fugues, which were a revelation to me about nuance and how, without sacrificing the independence of voices and sort of leading the listener through the pieces, she also had a kind of subtlety and poise, which Glenn, that's not his specialty. So I picked this, an English suite because I was doing things related to England. It's frankly a piece I don't know very well at all, and I'd never heard her recording of it, and I thought, well, this would be an opportunity for me to actually hear her do something I hadn't heard and discover what it's like.
Rosalind Turek played the Jig from the English Suite No. 3 in G minor by Johann Sebastian Bach. David Heidpierce, I imagine that being in a series like Frasier, which of course opens a lot of doors for you, but also I imagine was quite fun. And the interesting thing is that I know you're a great fan of Monty Python, as you said, and probably Fawlty Towers, and we've had people from the cast of that on this programme, I'm happy to say, several in fact, and they all spoke of it as being actually a very happy time. And I imagine this was for you from what I've read about it.
Yeah, it was. 11 years we did it. It was a joy. We were never tired of it. Because the writing was endlessly good, so innovative, and of course that's the great challenge of a long running series, is to come up with stories. And what they had done was created sufficiently interesting characters to begin with, that you could follow a story with each of them or any combination of them. And I think that's what helped. But beyond that, we were just great pals, all of us, and continue to be even now that the show is over.
Yes, that's always the final test, isn't it?
Yes, really. Yeah, no, Kelsey's now on Broadway doing La Cage aux Folles, and I just went and saw him open in that before I came here. And we all stay in close touch. And in fact, I think Jane Leaves, who played Daphne, and her family, she's coming over to England, and they're going to come see my show sometime soon.
Well, talking of things English, the Anglican Church, we mentioned your organ playing times, and I think that's developed in you a great love of the choral tradition of English music.
Yes, absolutely. One of the great experiences I had at Yale, I took a course in the music of William Byrd, and we had in a church done lots of Byrd and all the great tradition of English choral music. And as it happened, the man, and of course I'm going to blank on his name now, who was teaching the course, was in the middle of preparing, I think probably what is now the most recent critical edition of all of Byrd's works. And I went, it was a small seminar, and there were about 10 of us, and the next week there was just me. And at this point I wasn't even a music major anymore, I was just interested in Byrd's music. And he said, well, do you want a tutorial? And I said, fine. So I had one-on-one, week after week, this great man's experience and knowledge. He would take me through the ancient instrument collection at Yale, and fill me with what he knew about Byrd and his music. So that just struck a chord with me. I've always had a love for choral music, and specifically for music of the church like that. And this one particular anthem, I was glad of Perry, is one that we performed a lot, and always it's such an exciting, thrilling piece. But what I specifically remember is one day going to my organ teacher's house, and he had a new recording, and it was from the coronation of Elizabeth. And he said, you've got to hear this. And interpolated into the middle of the piece is this just mind-blowing Vivat Regina, which just shimmers out over the cathedral. And it's
so on an occasion of great sort of ceremony and magnificence, you had this music which kind of capped it all, or at least echoed it.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And just thrilling. And I still remember the moment of hearing it for the first time.
The anthem, I Was Glad, by Charles Parry. Ian Simcock was the organist with the choir of Westminster Abbey, conducted by Martin Neary. It's very often, David High Pearce, isn't it, an individual player that will introduce you to a new repertoire. You get to know someone, or you're taking part in something which takes you to other musical realms. And I think with the Mendelssohn, that was possibly the case, that with Stephen Hough.
Well, yes, I was very lucky. The first time I heard Stephen, it was a recording of the Mendelssohn, and was so taken with his playing. And I had the luck of actually, through a mutual friend, getting to meet him, and we're now very close friends. And he's as great a person as he is as an artist, which is also nice, because that doesn't always happen. But the first time I actually met Stephen, he came to a performance of Spamalot that I was doing. And in Spamalot, in one of the numbers I actually had a piano cadenza. And I would sometimes tailor what I played to if there was a special occasion or someone in the audience. And Stephen had very famous complete recordings of the Saint-Saëns piano concerto. So that night I threw in the opening of the G minor concerto for him, and he heard it. And so we met afterwards. And since then we've worked a lot on benefits for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS in New York, where he would come and play a house concert. He's played at my home to help raise money. Anyway, I so admire him in so many ways. And he can play anything, but there's something about this particular recording that just is so exquisite. And this movement in particular is such a gem.
Thank you.
the slow movement, the Andante, of the Piano Concerto No. 1 in G minor, Opus 25 by Mendelssohn. Stephen Huff was the soloist with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Lawrence Foster. You talked about playing in Spamalot, and I suppose there are a lot of analogies in music and the theatre, and perhaps the most important one is timing.
Yeah, Kelsey and I talked about that a lot. Kelsey is a musician. I think, especially with comedy, that there's a real link between having some sort of innate sense of musicality and understanding how to land on a line and when to back off and when sometimes something needs its phrasing. Just like I was thinking, listening to Rosalind Turek play that Gigue or Stephen, find the inner voices in what you don't think of as a contrapuntal piece. Having that ear and that sense for how to bring things out and a sense of nuance, I think those are very similar requirements for a musician and for an actor.
Although Berlioz, one sometimes thinks of as a bombastic composer, in fact, he wrote some incredibly tender pieces, didn't he? And in fact, this is one of them.
Yeah, this one was one that I did not know, and I was introduced to it in the most exquisite way possible. It's Beatrice and Benedict, which is his, I guess you'd call it an opera, based on Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. And it's an oddly constructed piece, and it was meant to be performed both by opera singers who would sing the arias and by actors who would act out the scenes in between. And I got to do this, it was, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, with Sir Colin Davis and the New York Philharmonic at Lincoln Center in New York. I got to act the part of Benedict. And in fact, Susan Gritton, who's singing in this recording, was also performing in that. And it was my introduction to the piece. It was also, although I admired Sir Colin, his work for many years, my introduction to actually meeting him and having the privilege of being on stage while he rehearsed the Philharmonic in this wonderful and funny, but also exquisitely delicate and beautiful piece. And I remember specifically one point where he was directing the strings. It wasn't in this movement. It was a very quiet, shimmering sort of string movement. And he stopped them and he said, "Don't play." He said, "If each of you doesn't play, that will be just enough sound." And of course, it's a psychological gambit, but the sound that then came out of each of those musicians doing their version of not playing, it makes the hair stand up in the back of my neck now. And it was the most gorgeous, ethereal, transcendent sound.
It was that intuition, I think, with Colin Davis that has meant that, in a sense, he has been to Berlioz for us what Charles Mackerras was to Janáček, a real passion, a real understanding, and a determination to share this beautiful music with everyone.
And the best man to make the case for it.
almost glancing back to the world of bel canto there, aren't we?
And also, I kept thinking, if it's not sacrilege, it was very Sullivan-esque. Or yes. Sullivan is very Berlioz-esque or something, but a lot of that.
I don't know if you got the impression that I got when was working with Colin Davis, which is, and this is true of most conductors, I suppose, but particularly with him, a feeling that he's almost humbled by the music, that he's in awe of something sacred in front of him.
Yes, even in his physical stance in conducting, you see that. And certainly you feel that it's not about him, it's about the music that's being presented.
We heard Susan Grittan singing music from Beatrice and Benedict, Act 1 by Berlioz with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Colin Davis. Now, David Hyde Pierce, I think at least part of your success can be traced back to your ability to fall over and fall downstairs.
Yes, well, that was the early roots of my dramatic work, is that when I was a little boy, as I said, I grew up in a small town. We had a big staircase in our house. And for some reason, I got into my head that I loved the idea of being shot and falling down the stairs. And so most mornings when I would come downstairs for breakfast, I would pause at the landing, get shot. And no one was watching. It was just for my own benefit. And then topple down the stairs. Something I now look back on and think I can't imagine how I did it, because I'd break in half if I did it now. But it certainly was an early warning sign of someone with serious dramatic problems. but also it led to much years later, when I was actually performing on stage and in Frasier, the kind of physical comedy that I was drawn to do had a lot to do with that.
Because they noticed that you knew how to fall.
Yes, early on they gave me some small bit in the kitchen with Daphne, where I sort of suavely tried to hoist myself up into the kitchen on island and instead banged my head on the pots and knocked myself out on the refrigerator. And it went very well, so they gave me more and more of that. Mm. And the flip side was that dramatically, in doing productions of Cyrano or productions of Hamlet, I had a lot of training in stage combat as well. So I was able to do sword fights and that sort of thing, which also they incorporated into a Frasier episode. They said, "Do you fence?" And I said, "Well, I did that sort of thing." And they gave me a conflict with my ex-wife Maris's fencing instructor, and we had a big battle during the show.
I suppose that the other thing that, most children love the idea of driving a train or a tractor, but probably for you and me, it was getting behind a mini-manualed organ.
Well, my great problem as an organist, was that I didn't understand, if you could pull out all the stops, literally, why would you bother to do anything else? That was my... And I used to, when I was in high school, I had the key to our local church. We had a wonderful Cassavant pipe organ. And I would go at night after doing my homework and let myself into the church and practice. But most of my practice would devolve into just putting on the full organ and playing as loud as I could and thinking how much fun that was. So it's a very unsophisticated approach to the instrument.
But it is a small boy's dream in a way, isn't it? Because you're at the controls of a mighty beast.
Yes. Yeah, it's amazing. And because it's not just the sound, it's the physical sensation of a real pipe organ, that you feel the ground shake under you.
Especially with a 32, 64-foot.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
that's great.
In fact, we just, in that church, my dad was on the vestry when they installed that particular organ. There had been a big Skinner organ. Skinner was one of the great American organ builders, and it had fallen into disrepair. And this was in the 60s, and they were going to replace it with some bad electronic version. And my dad was very adamant that they replaced it with a real pipe organ. And just this past year, my brother and sisters and I got together and donated to the church a small pipe organ for the gallery in honor of my mom and dad, as a sort of remembrance of our own musical experience at the church and also their contribution.
It's a nice story. Well, we're going to end, David, with a piece I think you probably played in those days.
I have played this piece almost recognizably. I don't think the composer turned too many times, but it's one of my favorite pieces for the organ. And what's beautiful about it is it was clearly, I think, an improvisation that someone wrote down of Louis Vierne.
Like a lot of sort of French organ music, you know, that you'd be given a theme and you would have to take it for a walk.
Yeah. Yeah, and this particular piece, the reason it's a French composer, the reason it's in my collection of English music is because the tune that he improvised on, that it's based on, is the chimes of Westminster Abbey, of Big Ben.
Of course, there's a 10 or 11 second delay in St. Paul's.
Good old St.
The theatricality of the piece.
I have to say, I took a chance on that recording because I didn't know it. And I had just been to St. Paul's with my family for Evensong. And I thought, chances are, and I was thrilled by that. It was a great performance of the piece.
We heard Andrew Lucas at the organ of St. Paul's Cathedral playing Carillon de Westminster by Louis Vierne. We've mentioned the things which, of course, you're most celebrated for, but when I look through your list of credits, it's absolutely amazing the number of things you've taken part in: Nixon, Sleepless in Seattle, Little Man Tate. Apart from the ones we've mentioned, are there any that stick out that have a particular place in your heart?
Oh, gosh. There are a few. I was very lucky. I got to work with Peter Brook, great British director Peter Brook. We did a production of The Cherry Orchard that we did first in New York and then took it on tour through the Soviet Union and to Japan. And that whole experience, both the touring, getting to do Chekhov in Russia, in what was then the Soviet Union, it was 1989, and also the chance to work with Peter. He was just a completely inspiring and amazing man to work with. So that certainly stands out as a great time in my life. There's so many. I've really been blessed with the people I've worked with and the material I've gotten to work.
And on. I suppose now, taking part in a play like La Bête every evening, it does mean that you're in a great city and you sometimes have time in the day to go into a church or a gallery or...
Yes, and the thing I haven't gotten a chance to do yet, because we've been doing publicities and interviews and such as this, is to go to some of the daytime concerts, because we have Wednesday matinees, so that gets in the way sometimes in Saturday matinees. But yes, I'm certainly hoping to, and I'll get back to St. Paul's for another Evensong, absolutely.
Well, you might be able to catch a lunchtime prom.
That would be fantastic.
David Hyde-Pierce, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
David Hyde-Pierce was talking to Michael Barclay. And next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the writer Hisham Mattar. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall.
The beatification of Cardinal John Henry Newman next month will mark the penultimate step on his journey to sainthood. In this week's Sunday feature, Edward Sturton explores the life and legacy of Cardinal Newman, whose religious views attracted controversy in his lifetime and even led to the accusation that he was the most dangerous man in England.
Perhaps one reason he's so difficult to pin down is that he's a poet as much as a theologian, a thinker whose understanding of God is based as much on imagination as it is on reason.
Roman Catholics were very much a minority. To have made that choice was really to go and join a church that many people thought was of the devil.
John Henry Newman, a very English saint. This week's Sunday feature at 9:45 in the evening here on BBC Radio 3.
We just have time before the news to look at tomorrow's Lebrecht interview in the evening. Norman Lebrecht will be talking to the American-born pianist Stephen Kovacevic in the year of his 70th birthday. He was originally from Los Angeles, but his father was Croatian and his mother was American. After studying with the Russian pianist Lev Shaw, he won a scholarship which brought him to London, where he met and studied with Dame Myra Hess. And she helped him to develop the sound that he made at the keyboard. In 1961, he hired the Wigmore Hall and made an acclaimed debut in music by Berg, Bach and Beethoven, the Diabelli Variations. And this was the real start of his career in public, which continues to this day. He's mainly confined himself to the great classical pianist composers, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert and Brahms, with occasional forays into the 20th century, although he's never played the music of Rachmaninoff in public, the pianist who, in fact, he most admires. Throughout his life, his playing life, Kovacevic has suffered badly from nerves, and he talks frankly about this and the way his more recent conducting career has helped him to deal with them. So that's the Lebrecht interview tomorrow evening here on BBC Radio 3 at 9:45. Well, now it's coming up to 1:01. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. This is David Cornick with a summary of the news. The Australian Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, has begun trying to form a coalition government after an inconclusive result in the country's general election yesterday. She acknowledged that neither her Labour Party nor the opposition Conservative coalition was likely to win the 76 seats needed for an outright majority. But the opposition leader, Tony Abbott, said it was clear that Labour had lost its legitimacy to govern. One of the legal experts who's called for a full inquest into the death of the weapons inspector David Kelly says detailed evidence from the post-mortem examination disclosed in a newspaper interview should be tested. In the Sunday Times, the pathologist Dr. Nicholas Hunt said the injuries were entirely consistent with self-harm. But Dr. Michael Powers, who earlier this month argued that the wounds to Dr. Kelly's wrists were unlikely to have been fatal, said the quality of the evidence hadn't been assessed. Tens of thousands of people are fleeing from fresh flooding in southern Pakistan. Rising water is threatening the flood defences in the city of Shahdadkot, where the army and local volunteers have raced to build a mud embankment. 200,000 people have been forced to leave their homes in the area in the past 24 hours. The government in Iraq has confirmed that a man who was convicted in connection with the kidnap and murder of a British aid worker has escaped from prison. Ali Lutfi Jasser al-Rawi was jailed for life last year for his part in the killing of Margaret Hassan in 2004. He'd been due to face a retrial. Police in Egypt have resumed their search for a painting by the Dutch master Van Gogh, which was stolen from a museum in Cairo. Earlier reports said the picture, which is valued at £30 million, had been found and the alleged thieves arrested at the city's airport. And the weather, there'll be occasional light rain in the far south and southeast of England throughout the day. Rain will become heavy and persistent in southwest England by the evening. Northern Ireland and Scotland will see sunshine and showers. Elsewhere, if there is anywhere else, it'll be dry with sunny periods. That's the BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one, and it's time now for the Early Music Show. And today, Catherine Bott pays tribute to one of the most celebrated musicians of the 15th century, Johannes Ockeghem. The programme begins with a reading of part of a lament on the composer's death, written by one of his contemporaries.
For Ockeghem we weep and lament, he who was skilled in the knowledge and practice of all the subtle secrets of the new art of song. Musicians must be restrained today, bathing their hearts with tears at seeing him dead on his couch, and say that his name shall always remain on our lips eternity to gain. For Ockeghem,